Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, magnify the Lord, for he is worthy to be praised. Oh, magnify the Lord, for he is worthy to be praised. Hosanna, blessed be the rock, blessed be the rock of my salvation. Hosanna, blessed be the rock, blessed be the rock of my salvation. Oh, magnify the Lord, for he is worthy to be praised. Oh, magnify the Lord, for he is worthy to be praised. Hosanna, blessed be the rock, blessed be the rock of my salvation. Hosanna, blessed be the rock. Oh, magnify the Lord, for he is worthy to be praised. Oh, magnify the Lord, for he is worthy to be praised. Hosanna, blessed be the rock, blessed be the rock of my salvation. Hosanna, blessed be the rock, blessed be the rock of my salvation. Oh, magnify the Lord, for he is worthy to be praised. Oh, magnify the Lord, for he is worthy to be praised. Hosanna, blessed be the rock, blessed be the rock of my salvation. Hello.
Welcome to the Grist of Freedom Show. I'm your guest host, Bob Seeley, filling in for Leslie, who is sick today. I'm a member of the Garrett family, and my family worked with William Still and Harriet Tubman, and many more in the Underground Railroad. Today, we're honored to have Professor Lynn Washington. Professor Washington is director of news editorial sequence and company, director of the Multimedia Urban Reporting Lab. He teaches courses at Temple University in news reporting, investigative reporting, and journalism law. Professor Washington considers it an honor to have the opportunity to serve his alma mater as a professor. Professor Lynn Washington, former reporter for the Philadelphia Tribune, wrote an in-depth article in 1987 about the Still family, an American first family. I'd like to welcome Professor Washington today to talk about the Still family. Welcome, Professor Lynn Washington. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Bob. How are you? Good evening.
Very good. Very good. I wanted to let you know, my son attended Temple University, and a friend of mine who I played football years ago, his name's Steve Joachim, and he's a broadcaster for Temple. We played on the same football team years ago. Dr. Nilgun Akur, who I appeared there at a conference many years ago. I think it was about 2005. And Professor Andy Wosky. And I was on the Dr. Gene Moore show at Temple Radio a few years back. I think that was probably about 2006. Now, back in 1987, you wrote about the Stowe family, who are my friends. I know Clem Stowe real well in Lawnside, New Jersey.
Yes.
And you called an American First family. Why is the Stowe family to you an American First family?
Well, this is truly a fascinating family that has played an integral part in just about every facet of the development of America in terms of its history. And in looking at the family and looking at its contributions over many, many generations, many centuries, clearly it's an American first family. And part of that, although I did not write that headline, part of it goes towards the stereotypes that African Americans have no histories of merit, and they don't have things of distinction, at least beyond the latter part of the 20th century. And the Stowe family and their legacies,
yes.
Just totally destroy that, as you very well know.
Yes, I do. Can you talk about the Stowe family involvement with the Underground Railroad?
Well, yes. Again, on many, many different levels. One, William Stowe was the person who ran one of the Underground Railroad offices here in the city of Philadelphia.
Yes.
And he was the one who was the first African-American to write a book about the Underground Railroad, and it was a book based on the notes that he kept while he served as secretary of the Vigilance Society in Philadelphia. And in writing that book, he became, I think, the sole African-American exhibitor at what became known as a World's Fair, the Philadelphia Exhibition of, I think, 1871 or 1877. And
yeah,
that was comparable
yeah.
to a World's Fair. So that was a significant event, not only the exhibition, but the fact that he wrote that book. And that book was written from the vantage point of an African-American was tremendous. And then when you look at it from what it said at that time, given the tenor of those times, it makes it even more fascinating. And when you look at the stories that are intertwined with the Underground Railroad, particularly the story that involved his brother, who purchases freedom, tried to find his family. And again, this runs so much against the stereotypes that have come down through the generations about African-Americans not caring too much about their families. And so many of us know that these are just flat lies. But these are the stereotypes that persist either subliminally or very consciously and conscientiously in people's minds. So we have Peter Stowe purchasing his freedom, wanting to reunite with his family, coming
yes.
to Philadelphia, and quite by the first thing that came to my mind was happenstance, but no, it was divine intervention.
Yes,
he ends up at the office of the Underground Railroad, and he's talking, and his brother realizes that this is the brother that his mother had told him about. And so that was such a tremendous story, and in many ways it's a Alex Haley Roots type story, but it took place
yes.
100 years or more before Alex Haley even had it in his mind to create that work that eventually he did that became a book and an extraordinarily moving and extraordinary moving in a societal way television series.
Well, when William Stowe was recording the information of the people running to freedom on the Underground Railroad, when he met Peter, I assume he probably asked him questions, and some of those questions must have been who his owner was, maybe members of his family. I assume that's how he found out it was his brother.
From my understanding and reading of the histories and also reading the account that was in William Stowe's book, he has a
yes.
very poignant account of it in there. He would go through a series of questions to get information from those who escaped. And in going through the routine questions that he would have, they started ringing bells in his head. And
yes,
those
yes.
bells were the stories that his mother told him And that's what it came to mind. And, it is, and again, the stereotypes have come down.
Yeah.
Peter Steele was very reticent to believe what his brother, in fact, was telling him, because he was told that he should not trust other people of color.
Yes.
You know, if you want to get somebody who's trustworthy and somebody who can really help you, don't trust somebody of color. Which, you know, was a pollution that they poured in to, you know, keep people from uniting with those who shared their desires for freedom and would be the most logical people to help them. Go ahead.
That's all right. The book that William Steele printed after he recorded this information, and I understand it was called the Journal C that he used, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was firsthand knowledge, and a lot of the books that we read on the Underground Railroad are not firsthand knowledge. So I assume this is very, very important information. I know Thomas Garrett from my family wrote to William Steele often, and I know he used some of the letters from other abolitionists. There's also a record. A book that recorded funds. I know he met Harriet Tubman,
mm-hmm.
and he recorded information. Can you enlighten me about the Journal C and also the funds? And also, could you talk about name changes? I noticed that there were some name changes.
Well, you may be a little more versed on that than I. I just know that in those days, people were very meticulous about recording everything. And,
yes.
of course, money being a very substantial element in the running of an Underground Railroad, there would be
yes.
a meticulous accounting of that. People were providing funds for a purpose, and these were very honest and scrupulous people. So they wanted to let folks know where these funds were going and how they were being spent. So there would be that accounting there, and that value of honesty and that value of being accountable to other people is something that we're losing in contemporary society, not only here in America, but around the world, and that's really a sad piece.
Professor Washington, after William Steele recorded the information, where would he send the freedom seekers to?
They would be sent further on north. Some would go to the west, others would go up into Canada, and some would, you know, eventually make it out into Nova Scotia, and some would go up into the northeast part of the United States, up into the Massachusetts, Vermont area,
yes.
where the intensity of slavery was not that much. Some people, well, Philadelphia again has a stereotype. I mean, I keep getting back to this phrase in word stereotype. Philadelphia has this veneer, this stereotype of being this very liberal bastion, the birthplace of American democracy.
Yes.
But the reality is Philadelphia is and has been a very racist place. And Frederick Douglass, I think it was either 1848 or 1842, you know,
yes.
characterized Philadelphia as the most racist city in the United States, second only to New Orleans. And so in Philadelphia, there was a lot of pro-slavery sentiment.
Yes,
there was a lot of affinity for the Confederacy during the Civil War.
Yes.
So it was an area where people had to be very, very careful about what they did and how they did it. There was an incident in Philadelphia, I think in 1838 or somewhere around there, where
yes.
the abolitionists, those who supported an end to slavery, had built a hall where they would meet and hold their meetings and whatnot, and there was a mob that burned it down.
Yes.
And
yeah.
the town fathers could not find anybody in that mob to arrest although the contemporaneous accounts of it said that these were people of known wealth and stature in the city who were a part of this mob. So there was this mob violence directed towards this facility and the people in it, and
yeah.
No one was held account for it because this undercurrent sentiment against what those people were for.
Yes, and they call Philadelphia the brotherly love.
Yeah.
But we didn't see it during a lot of times during the abolitionist movement, except for some people. And could you tell me about some of the people that, that William Still worked to get, with on the Vigilance Committee in Philadelphia?
Well, it really exemplified the best of what America could be and the best of what America has been and is. In that you had interracial workings on it. It was blacks and whites who were working together on this. Some people were people of means. Others were just people of good spirit, and they gave what they could,
yeah.
A place to stay, a transport point, hide in the bottom of my wagon. I'll take you here. I'll take you there.
Yeah.
There were African-Americans of means, who would participate in this. We have this notion that all African Americans prior to the Civil War were slaves. Well, that is just entirely not true.
I agree.
There were what they were called free people of color.
You're talking about
I'm sorry.
Professor Washington, you're talking about William Whipper and Dr. Stephen Smith?
I'm talking about those people.
Yes.
I'm talking about a whole host of others, not just
yes.
in Philadelphia, but all up and down what
yes.
was the United States at that time, which was primarily along the what we now know as the Eastern Seaboard.
And
these
and
were
William
people
Still,
who paid taxes, who but couldn't vote, who were essentially second-class citizens who themselves fought daily, or should we say faced daily, the constant threat of being snatched from their lives that they've worked so hard to maintain and put into slavery. I mean, the
yes.
Supreme Court of New Jersey rendered a decision in 1829 in the case where the justice who was writing it said, our court presumes that any black person that comes before us is a slave until the contrary is proven. Well, how do you prove the contrary if you cannot, if by custom and by race or racism, black people can't come in to testify? So if others, people who were deemed worthy enough, wouldn't come in to testify for you, people would be sent back or sent to the South. And some of these people who were sent South, who were enslaved, were never slaves at all. I mean, they were born free people.
Yes.
Parents who were either freeborn or emancipated.
Professor Washington, the Future of Slave Law, 1850, Jane Johnson. Do you want to talk about that, about Jane Johnson?
Yeah, well, that was an incident that happened here in Philadelphia. It involved the anti-slavery movement. She comes to town with a U.S. diplomat, and she desires to have her freedom. They were able to wrest her away from her slave owner physically and spirit her out of the city. She eventually wound up in, I think it was Massachusetts or one of those states up there, and she lived the rest of her life there. There was a trial for the people here in Philadelphia who
yes.
freed her. They were ultimately acquitted, but they spent over a year in jail awaiting trial.
Wow.
Philadelphia was a very bad place, and what the historical records now show that the judges that set on these proceedings that would send people back into slavery, I mean the persons who had escaped from slavery and they were recaptured under what you were saying, the Fugitive Slave Law, when they were come before these judges, the judges would get double the amount of money for sending someone back to slavery than they would for allowing them to go free. So there was a financial incentive that just disrupted all notions of impartiality and justice. And these trials that took place actually took place in what we now know as Independence Hall, where millions of visitors come every year to extol the writing and the issuance of the Declaration of Independence and the writing of the U.S. Constitution.
Yes, yes.
So these very documents that are the foundational documents of this country were written in a building where slavery was enforced. In 1799, a group of 70 black leaders in Philadelphia sent a petition to Congress. This was the first petition ever sent to Congress by blacks, seeking two things primarily. One, an abolition of slavery, but a gradual abolition of slavery, where they volunteered to help their brethren come up in terms of education and acculturation. But they also asked for relief from Fugitive Slave Act abuses for the free persons of color. So a slave owner or a slave or representative of a slave owner couldn't come in from Maryland or couldn't come in from South Carolina or North Carolina or Virginia and say, hey, that guy over there, that guy Bob, I think he's a slave. And then it would be your duty to prove that you weren't. And if you didn't have extensive records, and back in those days, I mean, people didn't have extensive records because a lot of people were just living a bare bones existence. A lot of those people got shipped down south and were put into this, you know, very oppressive and brutal chattel slavery. And all of this was happening under the veneer of the U.S. government.
Yeah.
The government that postulates itself as the defender, the preeminent defender of freedom in the world.
Wow. There's many stories about the Underground Railroad that William Still shares in his book, and there are many pictures of people he worked with, including Thomas Garrett. But there's a story about Box Brown coming to Philadelphia. Could you tell our listeners about Box Brown?
Yeah, and I think his name was Henry Box Brown. And the box part was that his method for getting out of slavery to an area where he could be free was to have himself nailed into a box. He was actually put inside a box. There was a little hole in there so he could breathe. He had a little food and a little water. And he was put on a freight wagon. And, again, we're not talking about a train. We're not talking about a FedEx airplane. We're not talking about a truck. We're talking about a horse-drawn wagon, and he was brought up, I think, from Virginia. And and there was in the account in Steele's book was that, you know, they were somewhat breathless because they knew he was in there, but they figured that the time it took for him to get there, I think it was like a week or a little more than a week, that they didn't know if he was going to be alive or not. And they were so surprised when they pried open the box and he pops up. Hey, I'm here. Thank you. But there were so many great stories.
Absolutely. And I read them in letters that I have in my Garrett family that was sent to William Still. And William Still was saved those letters. A lot of letters were destroyed. I know a lot of our Garrett letters were destroyed. I would like you to talk about William Still. After the abolitionists, after the Underground Railroad, during the time of the Civil War, he owned a business. And after the Civil War, he owned another business. Can you talk about his life after the during the Civil War and after the Civil War?
Yes, William Still played a very influential role in the city of Philadelphia, not just with the Underground Railroad. But he was a successful black businessman. In fact, venture to say he was a rich black businessman. He sold ice.
Yes.
He sold coal.
Yes.
He employed people. He got involved in politics where he was helping to enfranchise blacks in the city of Philadelphia. He pretty much led a fight to desegregate the trolley cars in the city of Philadelphia during the Civil War. Because there was when they started mustering blacks to be members of the Union Army,
Yeah.
There was a camp right on the outskirts of what was then Philadelphia. It's really right over the city line now, right in a place called, oh, God, I'm going to
Montgomery?
On the
is
name.
That
well, it's in Montgomery County, but there's Lamont, the Lamont
Lucretia, Lucretia.
Well, Lucretia Mott was the land of, from
camp
what I
William
understand,
Penn.
Came from Camp William Penn.
Yeah.
Right, and so he still would go out to visit the soldiers and, you know, give them moral support and, you know,
yes.
aid and assistance. And he would be subjected to discrimination on the trolleys, and they mounted a very sophisticated campaign to end that practice of that segregated practice on the subways. And it's amazing. That was during the Civil War, right?
Yes.
But during World War II in Philadelphia, the U.S. government, the federal government, during World War II had to order federal troops into Philadelphia because there was an effort to desegregate the trolleys then, and that effort was to get black motormen, people to actually drive the trolleys.
Yes.
And the unions were going to go on strike, and they were threatening to impact some of the war industries there because Philadelphia was a big shipbuilding region for the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Merchant Marines. And the federal government had to send in troops during World War II.
Wow.
Because of segregation and another effort to desegregate, something that should have been resolved over 100 years beforehand. So we see these recurrences of, and in the recurrence, the recalcitrance of racism in this country. And I would venture to make the assertion that we do not live in a post-racial era, irrespective of what a lot of people would want to say.
Yes. The Underground Railroad, then, was just the beginning of civil rights. There was a lot of work yet to be done and still to be done.
Oh, absolutely. And when we look at the civil rights movement, we need to put a longer lens on our examination of it. And I would fall much of that falling on the African-American side of the equation, because I think too much we have fallen into a kind of a Mac history sort of thing, like, you know, where we just go along with what other people say is okay. Well, you know, we'll say a little bit about Harriet Tubman, we'll say a little bit about Martin Luther King, and that's it.
Right.
Well, what about the William Stills?
I agree with you.
Yeah,
and
what about the Frederick Douglasses? What about the A. Philip Randolphs?
Robert.
If it wasn't for Malcolm X, then the Martin Luther King wouldn't have been able to do what he did. And King was very clear about that. It's just that us today, we don't want to make those recognitions. And if it wasn't for Marcus Garvey, there would not have been a Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. And the reality is that the civil rights movement got a lot of its traction, particularly traction among the leaders in Washington, D.C., because they're looking around, looking at the alternative, and they're saying, well, we don't want this Nation of Islam to get any more credibility. Well, who was the leader of the Nation of Islam? Elijah Muhammad. Elijah Muhammad was a Garveyite. Malcolm X's father was a Garveyite. But then we take for Garvey and we go back further and further and further. Garvey came to the United States ostensibly to meet with Booker T. Washington because he admired Booker T. Washington. So this struggle for equity and fairness in the United States goes way back. I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
That's all right. Professor Washington, I visit Eden Cemetery every year and put a wreath on William Still's grave because to my Garrett family is a hero. But there's another gentleman buried in Eden Cemetery, and Eden Cemetery is a lot of heroes in Eden Cemetery.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a man by name, and in fact, I spoke there a couple of years ago, Octavius Cato. Who's a hero to me and many people, and they don't know the story about Octavius Cato. We only have a few minutes, and could you touch on that for me?
Yeah, sure. Octavius Cato was a leader in Philadelphia around the 1870-1880 period. He was a political leader, and I needed to make a little addendum to the story about William Still. Near the latter part of his life, he was criticized by the Octavius Catos for not being militant enough. So here's a person who stood up and fought, and generationally, he time kind of passed him, although he felt that his brand of politics was the way to pursue it. Octavius Cato, again, with this spirit of militancy that, you know, is passed down from one generation to another, he started challenging the system, and he was murdered on South Street. I think it was around 8th and South, another series of election riots. It seems like certain things just never stop in Philadelphia. And his murder did create some change in the city, some recognition that they needed to do things just a little bit differently. And from what I understand, I mean, there's been a really good book written about Octavius Cato that has come out within the last 2 years, and I understand that there's an effort now to put a statue up somewhere honoring Octavius Cato in Center City. But he's a person that should get some recognition. But again, we too often don't give our heroes the respect that they should. I mean, there was a very vigilant effort in Philadelphia, and I think a good one, you know, to name one of the drives through the park along the river in the name of Martin Luther King. But, you know, while Philadelphia was very pivotal for King in terms of his education, in terms of his activism and awareness, in terms of his support for his efforts throughout the civil rights movement, why don't we do something for Octavius Cato? Why don't we do something for Fannie Mae Coppin, whose emphasis on industrial education actually predated Booker T. Washington down in Tuskegee? These were Philadelphians. Let's do something for the Philadelphians.
I agree with you.
Another conversation,
Professor,
for another day, sir.
I agree. There's a DVD, by the way, coming out on Still Family. I think it's coming out February, I believe. Can check on Leslie Gist's webpage, Facebook.
Okay.
And there's a DVD coming out, which I'm looking forward to seeing. I know there's a DVD of William Still and Thomas Garrett that was put out a couple of years ago, Whispers of Angels, which I've seen. It's a wonderful DVD. I'd like to thank you, Professor Washington, for sharing your knowledge.
Thank you very much, not
just showing it, you share it, and I do appreciate that. About the Still family, to our Garrett family, William Still and the Still family are heroes, and they shared with us a part of our American history that wasn't taught when I was in school, and it should be taught. And a lot of these American heroes you're talking about are forgotten. And we need education, just like Frederick Douglass said.
Yeah,
this is Bob Seeley filling in for my dear friend Leslie Gist on the Gist of Freedom. Thank you, Professor. One of these days we'll meet up.
Okay, very good.
Thank you
so
much.
Have a nice evening and a great show. Right, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.